Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. A form of intelligence gathering is already taking place at the new site for the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency. Archaeologists are having a field day. As the 100-acre site is being cleared, a team is looking for historical artifacts, and team members are finding them fascinating clues as to how people lived there more than a century ago. They hope to perhaps find evidence of cultures from long before that. Joining me by phone from the site is Joe Harrell, Principal Investigator for Archaeological Research Center of St. Louis. Joe, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And for taking time out of your busy day. You guys are keeping very busy there, aren't you?
Very busy. We are finding a tremendous number of cisterns, privies, and lots of artifacts.
All right. Well, it's the privy part that I want to start with. That doesn't sound like the best job in the world to me, but it's really a boon for you folks, isn't it?
It really is, because privies are sort of like little time capsules, and they were used for short periods of time before they had to be cleaned out. In the 1900s, early 20th century, they didn't have trash collection. So what you do is just dump your garbage down the privies. And so as a result, it shows you pretty much about what their lives were like at different times in the past. Sometimes you can actually attribute the refuse to individual family, for instance. So it's kind of interesting, looking at privies.
What kinds of things are you finding and have you found so far?
Oh, we have too much to even account for, but there's a large number of bottles, ceramics, buttons. We found a button that supported World War I veterans, just all kinds of things. We even found a gold tooth in one of the bottles, so we're speculating how that got there. Turned up a pirate ship today, a 10 pirate ship out of one of the privies we were looking at. So you just never know what you're going to find in these things.
Is your focus totally on the privies and cisterns, or are you going broader, more wide area, a wider area than that?
We are looking at a wider area. We're looking at any pits that are in the – we're primarily concentrating in the yard areas where pits were filled pretty quickly, and so they provide you better information. We are documenting building remains. The problem with buildings is that they were torn down about 10 or 20 years ago, and all the rubble pushed into the cellars. So you've got a mixture of modern stuff. For instance, we found a George Benson record in one of those just the other day, and with older materials. So it really doesn't tell you as much as the privies and the cisterns and the yard features that were filled more rapidly and used for shorter periods of time.
You're pretty much under the gun on this, aren't you? I mean, you have a specific time frame in which you can continue to do what you're doing?
Right, yes. They would like us to be finished by September 1st, because at that time they're going to start letting contract to raise the buildings and remove the utilities and that sort of thing in the area. So, we would be in their way if we were still doing this. So it's very important that we get finished in a timely manner. And that's one of the things we always strive to do, is to work with the developers and get finished under their schedule.
Well, the schedule is also, I gather, dictated to some degree by the federal government, isn't it? I mean, you have to do this. This is a federal law to do what you're doing.
Yeah. In fact, in Missouri, that's the only way we know about the prehistory, for instance, of Missouri, is because of that federal law. The federal laws were passed primarily in the 1960s and 70s. There were earlier ones, but primarily in the 1960s and 70s, which requires that archaeology or any documentation of our cultural heritage be performed prior to any project using government funding, using a government permit, or on government lands. And the way the law reads, it's the developer who pays for that, unlike in other countries where the taxpayers pay for it. And that's because, really the developer is the one who profits by the destruction of the community's cultural heritage. So I think that's a fair ruling, that they have to pay for the documentation of these things. But it's so cheap. Archaeology is so cheap. It's amazing. It's always less than 1% of an overall construction cost. And this project, we're far below 1%. So it's for that little bit of money, we are finding a tremendous amount of cultural information that can not only help us to better understand the past and appreciate people from different cultures today, but also can improve our lives today. For instance, quinoa. Everybody always thought the Native Americans ate corn. Turns out quinoa was the number one crop that they ate. And now we know it's actually a superfood with all kinds of good amino acids and things for us. So who knows what medicines, ideas, foods that could come out of doing archaeology.
Do the developers tend stand to profit from what you're finding? I mean, some of the things you're finding probably have some value. Who gets control of that?
The control of that, is, since it's being done because under government rules, it's safe for the people of the United States. And so everything we find, we clean it, we catalog it, we put it in acid-free boxes and in plastic bags with, you know, documenting exactly where it's from and that. And then it gets sent to a curation facility where it's there for future generations to use and to appreciate. Who knows what new technologies, new techniques that'll develop in the future. And so having these things available for them to look at and research. For instance, just a few years ago, they found by scratching the insides of cooking pots, you could actually develop the find out what the last recipe of the last meal cooked in that cooking pot. And that's a technology that wasn't available to us a few years ago. So who knows what new ideas will come up. And then they're also available there for teachers to use or for museums to use. So it's there for the good of everybody. And the developer doesn't keep the objects ours and sells them. And we don't sell them at all. It's there for the future generations to use.
But where will they physically reside?
In a curation facility. And what that is, it's basically a big warehouse, which has climate-controlled rooms and alarm systems and that. And everything's, you know, cataloged, so you know exactly where it's at. And that way, if anybody wants to use that material in the future, they can.
So,
with the only stipulation that it be returned back to that curation facility once they are finished with it.
But they wouldn't necessarily just be open to the public, like a museum or...
You could request to see the materials. Mm-hmm. Yes, anybody can request to see materials.
This is a big site you're working, but you're not working all of it. How did you decide, if my numbers are correct, and correct me if I'm wrong, you've got, what is the size of the site?
It's 99 acres.
99 acres.
We're looking at 5 acres, so about 5% of the whole area.
That's not very much.
No, it's not. And it's one of those things, we could spend the time and dig the whole 99 acres, but a lot of these trenches that we're having to dig go down 10 feet deep. And so you can imagine trying to dig 99 acres 10 feet deep across the whole thing would take forever, as not to mention all the features you'd have to dig out. So what we did is, and that's what you do in an urban context, in an urban setting like this, you do a good archival review, a good historical archival review, where you look at the census. We looked at the city directories. We looked at fire insurance maps, city atlases, any kind of resource that we could use. And, you know, people are stopping by telling us their tales of what they remembered while I was here. And all of that helps you to build this picture of what this community was like. It's kind of funny, when I went out here, I almost felt like I've lived here in a sense after researching this for over a year now. And, you know, it's funny because you can say, well, in this street corner here, there was a Catholic church, and on this place, there was a store. That information then can help guide where we want to look at. For instance, we're looking at the Catholic Church and the school that was associated with it, but we're also looking at a German church and a school that was associated with that, and we're looking at a public school. So we can see those three different places, how the children of those three different areas worked and are studied and went to school and activities they did. Similar sorts of things, we're looking at different types of businesses. We're looking at different types of homes. Some of them are middle-class business owners who lived here, so we're looking at their homes. We're looking at some of the flats that were occupied, that were rented by typically by four families, but sometimes there's as many as six or eight families living in these small family flats. And we're looking at, homes that people owned. So we're getting a real diversity. And then we're looking at people who are of German immigrant families, as well as those who have lived in the United States for a long time, African-American families. We're looking at the Irish families, and later on, Italian and Eastern Russian families who lived here. So we're getting a real of the diversity of what the community was.
Just be sure that I understand. You're looking at structures that are above ground and maybe finding some evidence of older structures below ground. Is that right?
Yeah. What we're finding is all the where we're digging right now, all the structures have been raised. They've been destroyed some years ago, about 10 or 20 years ago. So what we're looking at is just the foundations and the cellars. That's what we're exposing of those buildings. But with the fire insurance maps, we can actually use those to pinpoint exactly where we're at in the block and which we know exactly which building we're behind, because the fire insurance map shows you the shapes of the buildings. And so you can tell by the shape that you're right here at this spot. So it's pretty neat way of looking at the past. You can actually see the buildings and then know when you're digging this privies and cisterns behind that who lived at those residences at different times.
You had a head start on this, as you've indicated, looking at various census and insurance information going back a year. Mm-hmm. But have there been any surprises to this point?
I'm sure there I have. And I've been mostly tracking the backhoe, but I'm trying to think of I'm sure there's a million surprises that I can tell. Well, I guess one of the things we're running across are these water closets that were after it's the history of restrooms actually are kind of fascinating. The early restrooms were basically privies where you dug a deep vault in your back and lined it with rock or with stone or with brick, and the bottoms were open so that all the liquids would flush out. And it's often interesting because right next door to those privies would be wells. And at the time, people believed that you caught diseases by the bad vapors, the bad smells. If it's some smell bad, that was carrying disease. They didn't understand germ theory at the time. And in about the 1870s, 80s, when germ theory became understood, then they started saying, well, you got to close off the bottom of those privies. So now they would be lined with stone and or with brick and put mortar over that. And they would run water off their roofs and at one end of that privy, and then a lower pipe at the lower end, which would take the water, the wastewater to a sewer, and then from the sewers, it would go ultimately to the local creeks and streams.
Well, you know, in our earlier segment, we talked about the cholera epidemic of 1849, and it sounds to me like what you're talking about might have played a role in that.
Oh, very much so, very much so. We looked at, yes, when you're looking at this, and various other epidemics, not only just the cholera, but the various epidemics they played. It's amazing to me that anybody survived the 1800s when you're looking at these small spaces and their open privies emptying right into their water system. It's amazing. And then a lot of times when they would dig out these privies, they would use that to fertilize their agricultural fields. Huh. So it's amazing to me whether anybody survived the 1800s. But that's one of the interesting things of looking into it, you know, because today we think if you jam in a lot of people into a small space, yeah, you learn a lot of tax dollars and you increase the income of the city initially, but ultimately are you developing the slums of the future by jamming that many people into a small space?
What's
the best way of urban design?
This was a densely populated space then.
Oh, extremely densely populated. They had two, three-story flats and apartments and homes on the streets, and then immediately behind them in the alleys, they had two or three-story flats and apartments. So you had a space, about 20, 30 feet wide where they would have their privies and their water system, their water source. So it's extremely packed in there.
I'm a little confused on one point, Joe. You talked about the various populations that moved in and out of this area, the Irish, the African Americans, and the Germans. But you also mentioned Native Americans, and you could determine some of the things that they were eating. I mean, that's a population that would predate these other groups that we're talking about.
Exactly. Well, somewhat. Actually, we had a couple of Native Americans who actually lived on this block or in this area. That'd be interesting to see if we can find them. But this was in the 1900s, early 1900s. But you can. What we are also looking for are the prehistoric evidence of prehistoric existence at this location. And unfortunately, where we're at here, I don't think we're going to have a very good chance of hitting it. We are very high in the prairie uplands. The nearest major source of water is almost a mile away. So it's not a very good place for prehistoric people to have lived. Now, they may have hunted or done some other activity up here. We're not even near sinkholes. Sinkholes were oftentimes plugged and formed natural lakes that they could use. And we're not even near a sinkhole at this location. Lots of it around us, but not where we're at. But we're certainly looking for any prehistoric remains. And believe me, St. Louis has prehistoric remains intact. Unfortunately, it just hasn't been found there yet. We did a project, and similar project in Hannibal, Missouri, where we found the original. We were working on the original part of the city at the top. As you get down to the bottom, you got the original Hannibal, and then below that was a 2,000-year-old village where prehistoric people had lived at that same location. And the same thing exists here. Cities don't really, everybody always assumes they destroy everything. What they do is actually build up the landscape over time. And so older things actually tend to get buried instead of destroyed.
Well, there were the Indian populations, the Cahokian tribes. That's not prehistoric. That's more recent. There's a lot of indication that they were on this side of the river.
Yeah, exactly. And they would be considered prehistoric. Prehistoric is anything prior to the arrival of the Europeans who brought written language with them. And so, even Cahokia would be counted as prehistoric in essence, because that would be before that time. And we don't know of any known writing system that people at Cahokia had, which is interesting because usually people at that level of society typically did have some type of writing system. So it could be something on bark or something we're just not seeing now. And certainly St. Louis had a major mound group at that time. In fact, several of them. There was one also in O'Fallon Park, not only the one in depth by the arch, but there's one near O'Fallon Park that had a large mound at that location as well, and several other places.
What we'd really like to find out is, they were called the Mississippians, I believe. We'd really like to find out what happened to them. All of a sudden, they were gone.
Exactly. Yeah, that would be the real mystery. That would be the real, because it's interesting, because after the Mississippians, the whole area appears to be abandoned by people. And that's really strange, because before that time, ever since the end of the last ice age, all the way up to 1400 AD, this area had the largest human populations in the country. And it's a real mystery why they abandoned this area so completely after 1400 AD. For instance, we have not found a site from 1400 AD to 1700 AD when the French start moving into the area. So it's a real mystery why people abandoned this area. You know, and again, maybe it's telling us something. Maybe something we need to be, some warning we need to be aware of. Sure. And so that's the reason. You know, we do archaeology to understand the past, but it's to help improve our lives today. And the other thing is, what makes a city unique? What makes it special? Is it its modern shopping malls? Is it the Starbucks at every corner or the McDonald's at every corner? It's its cultural heritage. People go to London, England, not to visit the stores and the shops, but they go more to learn about the cultural heritage that they have. And St. Louis has an amazing cultural heritage that people around the world would love to come and see and learn about.
And that Mississippian culture, too, it extended to Mexico, from what I understand, and as far north as Wisconsin. So they had really had something going at one time.
Yeah, it's funny, because when people in St. Louis started to destroy the mounds, people from Europe were coming over in 1840 saying, wow, why don't you make this a park and dedicate it to your past? And put in walking trails and gardens and make it a monument to the past and for people to learn from. And they decided instead to throw in tenements and flats and jam in as many people as they could into these places. Again, a good short-term benefits, but the long-term benefits were very detrimental. And so it's one of those things that, and then in the 1950s, 60s, we decided, hey, we needed a park in St. Louis, which is right near where the mound grew. So we built the arch at that time.
Yeah. Joe, we've only got 15 seconds left. How far back in time can you go if you're digging down 10 feet?
Right now, we're going only about to the 1880s, and we're thinking we're going to find something about 1850s. But unfortunately, I don't think we'll find any prehistoric, but we could. We could find older. So we're hoping we do.
Keep us posted on what you find, Joe. This is fascinating stuff, and we'd like to keep up to date with you if you don't mind.
Nope. Be glad to. That'd be great.
Thank you. Joe Harrell, Principal Investigator for Archaeological Research Center at St. Louis. Thank you once again, Joe Harrell. Archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.